As you know, we're into a series, and the series is Getting Past Your Past. And we, over the last couple weeks, we've looked at forgiveness, and then last week we looked at rejection. And the takeaway from those sermons, and it'll be the takeaway even again today, is remember, you can't reach for what's in front of you until you let go of what's behind you. And today's topic is one that will fit in, as I said, with this statement, but it's one we're all familiar with as well, because today we're going to be looking at failure. Failure. There are times in our lives when we can laugh at our failures. You've had moments in your life that would be very much like the Pinterest moments where you thought you nailed it and it just fell apart. And yet we also know that there are other moments in our lives, other seasons in our lives, things happen where we fail, and the consequences are long-lasting. They go deep within us, and they touch us at the deepest level possible. And when we're going through that, we really can wonder, can we ever get away from this sense of failure? I'm asking Janice Farhood to come this morning. She's going to share her story on failure.
If Pastor Marshall would have just asked, I could have added a couple things to that little slideshow, and some of you know what I'm talking about. Bess. I started figure skating when I was about 5 years old, loved it, and I, you know, the older I got, the more time I put into it, the more serious I got. I would skate probably anywhere from 9 to 12 hours a week, and I actually started to move up all the different levels, and I had some success. And as I got into high school, I was getting close to being at the kind of the top level that you could get at, as a skater. It didn't mean I was going to go to the Olympics. It just meant that I could coach and I could be involved in the sport in other ways. So there's a few tests that I needed to pass to get to that level. And I had had success in competing. So I would go out and I would skate for the judges and I could win competitions. But every time I had to skate for a test, my nerves just got the best of me. And, you know, it was the same judges and you're doing the same thing, but I just couldn't seem to do it. So one summer, I was invited to go to an intense training program. I lived in a little town called Armpryor, and this was the east end of Ottawa. It was about an hour and 15-minute drive, and I skated 5 days a week, probably about 6 hours a day, but with the drive, it was an all-day thing. I worked really hard. I missed out on a lot of other things. A lot of my friends were doing things I wasn't able to do, but I was working really hard. I had some goals, and I really wanted to achieve them. So at the end of the 4 weeks, it was time to do... I did all three disciplines of skating. I did figures, which doesn't exist anymore, free skate, and dance. So it was time for my first test, which was my figures test. And they used to have figures even at the Olympics, but you would never see it on TV. There would not be an audience. It wasn't, you know, televised in any way because you needed so much concentration to do it. The judges stood on the ice right beside you. There was about 8 components to the test. So you would go and you would skate one figure, and then you'd kind of go off to the side, and the judges would sometimes even get down on their hands and knees. They were looking at your tracings and your edges to make sure they were perfect. I was about 5 figures through, and I saw the judges starting to talk, which is not a good thing. And then they started to give their sheets to the head judge. And I knew what was about to happen. I was about to get kicked off the ice. That meant that I wasn't doing well enough to even bother skating the rest of my test. So it's kind of humiliating. You know, everyone knows that you're not done yet, but you're done. So I was pretty disappointed about that, but I was still hopeful because what I really loved to do was my free skate. I loved to jump and I loved to spin. And I thought, okay, well, that was figures, and that was hard, but I've got the next one. So later on that day, I took to the ice to skate my free skate program. Ended up falling on a required combination jump. which kind of threw me off a bit. I made a couple little mistakes, but I thought, you know, there's still a chance maybe I pass this one, because this is the one that meant the most to me. So you have to wait around. I found out my results. I had one pass and two fails, which equals a fail. And they were not politically correct. You'd get your papers back and there would be a big fail on the bottom. So I was feeling pretty devastated. I was in no mood to do the Argentine tango, which was my last test. And the judges could tell. So I went out, did that with a partner that I had that day to do my test. And I knew as soon as I was finished that, you know, you can see where this is going, that it wasn't going to be a good result. I got off the ice. My coach was trying to say something to me and my partner, and I just ignored them, and I just made a beeline for the change room. I somehow threw off my skates, and I went and I found the emptiest corner of the rink, found a bathroom that nobody was in, and I just kind of broke down, and I just cried. I just felt the hugest sense of disappointment and failure. This is, you know, I'm in grade 12 at this point. I had spent my life to this point putting time and effort into skating. And I just felt like I'd let myself down. I had let my coach down. I'd let my mom down. She's a single mom. She had sacrificed so much for me to do this. And if I could have just passed one thing, like, there just wasn't one thing to feel good about. So I, you know, in the next months, I didn't quit skating right then, but I was in my last year of high school, so I had to get a job. I was working quite a lot, and I didn't have the time to put in to skating that I had. I will tell you that I went on to fail again, but I ended my career on that note. I never did achieve the goals that I wanted to in skating, so that's sort of the end of the story.
Thanks, Janice. It's not really the end of the story. We'll get there in a little bit. But as you've listened to Janice, many of you are reliving the epic failure that you can point at in your life. And as you listen, the sting of that failure, the pain of that failure, you understand maybe even today that it runs deep. And it, as it has done even for Janice, it can last a long time as you work through it. See, we all know that failure has the ability to cause us to retreat from life. We can't do it, so we're just going to retreat. Janice mentioned that in her story. It causes us to recoil from situations. There's no way I can do that. I'm not even going to try again. We also know that failure has a way of separating people, especially in homes where a parent can feel that they were a failure as a parent. And it's brought some distance between them and their child, or from a child's perspective, because they have failed. It's brought distance and harm into the relationship with their mother or father, or maybe even a sibling. As I thought about failure, I began to think about it, and I thought, what is there something that you can compare it to? And I thought of a total solar eclipse. Because when you have a total solar eclipse, it impacts one area of the world specifically. And when it does, two things happen. One is the temperature drops, and the other is it goes dark. And whenever we deal with failure in a very deep level, whenever we failed at something that we thought should go our way, I have found in my own life, and I'm sure you have found as well, it was expressed by Janice, all of a sudden, your world becomes cold and it becomes dark. There doesn't seem to be any life in it. And you wonder how you can move out of this darkness. As I thought about what Bible character that I would choose to look at this issue of failure, there are many that I could have chosen from. And that really, that made me happy, and it should make you happy as well, that there are a lot of people in the Bible who failed. Because they're just like us. They've all faced it. And so I settled very quickly on one. This morning, I want to use the game that Brad Loveday, he uses on his Faith FM show on the afternoons. And if you've listened to Faith FM, you'll have heard him do this, I'm sure. But Brad has this game, and if you're not aware of it, what happens is he gives clues to people. They try to either they're trying to get from the clues, they're either trying to decide, is he identifying a person or is he identifying something? But he kind of tells you which one of those two it's going to be. And then the clues come. And so this morning I thought I would play with you. God made him. Who is he? You may have heard him say, God made it. What is it? But I've just kind of changed it to fit my own needs this morning. So here are some clues. See if you can figure out who I'm talking about. He was Barnabas' cousin. His home is mentioned in Acts as a place where the disciples prayed. Peter considered him to be a son. Paul lost respect for him. And he wrote one of the four Gospels. Mark, that's right. Keyfly was dead on. It's Mark. Here's some snippets of Mark's story. Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their ministry. And they also took with him John, whose surname was Mark. And as we look at this scripture, what we understand is that Paul and Barnabas, they'd been down there, had been taking care of some things, and now we're traveling back to Antioch. They kind of made it that their home base. They had been seeing some great things happen, and as they leave Jerusalem, they take John Mark with them. He was a resident of Jerusalem, and he begins to travel with them. But when they, as you can see in Acts 13:5, and when they arrived in Salamis, so what has happened now is that they're back in Antioch, but now God has spoken to the disciples in Antioch and said, separate for me Barnabas and Saul for the work I have called them to. And so now they're leaving Antioch to go on their first missionary journey. That's why they, when they arrived in Salamis, they preached the word of God in the synagogues of the Jews. They also had John as their assistant. So it's important that we understand that John Mark had a designated purpose on this trip. He was there to fulfill a specific assignment. His assignment was to assist them. We don't know exactly what that means, but they were counting on him. But between this verse and just a few verses from here, we read, and now when Paul and his party set sail from Paphos, they came to Perga in Pamphylia, and John departed from them, returned to Jerusalem. Something happened. Nowhere in Scripture are we told exactly what it is, but John Mark fails to follow through on his commitment to Paul and Barnabas. He bails. He heads back to Jerusalem. He says, forget it. I'm not going to assist you guys anymore. I'm out of here. And so he heads back to his home. After some time, once this missionary journey is complete, Paul and Barnabas are back in Jerusalem. And as they begin to share the story of what's happening, they begin to just sense something stirring in their hearts. Acts 15 says that after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us now go and let us now go back and visit our brothers in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they are doing. Now Barnabas was determined to take with him John called Mark. But Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. Then the contention became so sharp that they parted from one another. Here we have these two great men, Barnabas and Paul, and they are in serious disagreement. Notice that it says that Barnabas was determined to take Mark. He was resolved. It was in his heart. There was not going to be any changing of his mind. This tells me that they probably had some conversation about this. And then when the trip comes, Barnabas says, oh yeah, by the way, remember what I told you. We're taking John Mark with us. But Paul, it says, insisted that John Mark was not going to go. There was no way in Paul's mind or in Paul's world that this man was getting on another ship. He wasn't going to walk another kilometer with this man, because he considered John Mark to be unworthy for missionary work. He wasn't fit to be an assistant. He wasn't fit for anything. Paul saw Mark as a failure. Now, this is a very public discussion, disagreement. So you can imagine how as this was being played out amongst the Christians in Jerusalem, you can well imagine how Mark felt. Some of you know exactly what it's like to have lived in a similar situation. You've experienced the open rebuke. You've had your failure exposed in a very public way. Maybe it was as you were being led out of the office at 9:05, after having just arrived at 9:00. You understand the pain. You understand the humiliation of such an event. But what is really incredible is that this isn't the end of the story. I paused in the middle of verse 39. Now let me show you what the end of 39 says. And so Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus. Mark ends up on another missions trip. He ends up with Barnabas. But can I tell you that this isn't even the end of the story? We'll get to the end of the story at the end of the message. But I just want to kind of camp here in terms of what had happened in Mark's life and what is happening. Because I believe there are some things, as I've looked at Mark's life, that we can learn about failure that I've seen even from my own life. And I would say to you that the essence of this is really found in this thought, that Mark failed forward. And it's something we all can do. We can fail forward. As I wrote that, it reminded me of Solomon, one of Solomon's Proverbs, one of his wise sayings. He said in Proverbs 24:16, "For though the righteous fall 7 times, they rise again." The Izinga translation is, though you fail 7 times, you just get up again and keep going. When you think about failing forward, and I thought about it in my own life, and I look at it in the life of Mark, they're not really 4 steps that you would kind of follow, as it were, in, you know, one after the other, but I think they're just 4 principles that we need to be able to understand how we can fail forward. The first one is that we need to make an honest appraisal of the situation. Back when I was at the dealership working for my dad, whenever the trucks would come that had the new cars on them, always created a commotion for a number of reasons. And I remember one day I was in my office and I knew the truck had pulled up because I had heard them say, "Hey, the truck's here," and so I knew what that meant. And then all of a sudden I heard a little different commotion, because my dad he had been out to talk to the driver, and then he came back in and he said, "General Motors has had to have made a mistake, because there's no way that we ordered that one truck." And so he said to me, "Marsh, go out and take a look." And so I go out, and there is a 3/4-ton pickup it's a 4-door pickup, but there is no pickup box on the back end of it. It is just chassis. And Dad said, "That has to be a mistake by General Motors. Will you check it out? Like, we would never order a truck like that." And he was right. So I go out, and the driver shows me the bill. I'm thinking, "Oh, good night." So I go running in, and I find the order form. And as I find the order form, I realize there's a problem. And then I look at the slip, the pre-build slip that was sent to us. And the pre-build slip matches what we had ordered, which is what the truck was. Which means that the problem, the failure in this moment is mine. Because, see, I ordered all the vehicles for the dealership. And on this truck, even we sold a lot of trucks as we were out in the country. On this truck, for some reason, I, instead of putting E63, which was the pickup box, that was the designation, that was the code for pickup box, I wrote AS3, which meant it came with no box. My dad looks at me and goes, "You ordered that?" The people in dealership go, "Marshall ordered that?" They were laughing at me. And I am sinking. I can't believe it. This truck, what in the world are we ever going to do with this truck? I talked to the parts manager and he said, "Marsh, we can't order in the parts for it because it's just going to make the truck too expensive." Like, buddy, you failed miserably on this one. And I remember just standing there for a bit, looking at this truck, thinking, this thing is going to haunt me forever. We'll never get rid of this thing. And it was difficult as well, because it sure wasn't a fun thing to have to admit to everybody at the dealership that I was the one who had made that mistake. I think about Mark, and I think about him, and how that he had to make the trip back from Pamphylia back to Jerusalem, and that would have been a long trip. It would have been quite a time for him as he thought about what had happened and what he thought he was able to do but didn't do. And I just wonder, if you ever thought of not returning to Jerusalem, because sometimes when we fail, the last place we want to do is we don't want to go home. We don't want to deal with the people who know, right? But he heads back home, and I really believe that as he did, he began to assess the situation. He took appraisal of what had happened. I don't know who it was that really started to get to help him in this regard. But I can tell you that when Barnabas returned to Jerusalem, that Barnabas would have been a help to him. Because, you see, he knew that Barnabas believed in him. And he had a strong conviction as he came back into the city that indeed Mark could do something. He didn't have to be a failure. He didn't have to let this failure define his life. Like I said early in the service, we all fail. Failure really is a part of life. But always remember that we may fail, but we are never failures. And if that thought has gone through your mind and that has, it's found a lodging place, and then the enemy has watered that thought that you are a failure, let me tell you that that is a lie. That is not the truth. You are not a failure. We all face failures. We all face disappointments. And so the question is not whether we're going to fail, it's but how will we deal with failure? You know, when we admit our failures, we admit our mistakes, what we're doing is we're owning up, we're taking responsibility for our own action or maybe our inaction. When we admit failure, it takes us along the right road. It gets us back to where we need to be because what it does, it helps develop and maintain a positive attitude. I can get through this. I can get out of this. You see, we need to remember that because we're human, failure is unavoidable, but it isn't irreversible. And therefore, failure is never final. Pastor Tim sent me this line. He said, let failure refine you. Don't let it define you. Let failure refine you. Don't let it define you. The second thing is that once you make an honest appraisal of the situation and you take a look at it and you say, okay, this is where I failed, then what you need to do is you need to really, it's so helpful to be able to spend some time with somebody who believes in you. I've already told you that it was difficult to be in the dealership for a number of days because, man, I just got taunted about that truck. But I will tell you that about an hour after that truck arrived and my dad understood what had happened, he came into my office and he said to me, Marsh, I just want you to know we're going to sell that truck. We're going to sell it. It's going to go. It's not staying here. And I remember looking at him and smiling and saying, thanks, Dad. But in my heart, I went, Dad, like you heard the auto truck driver. He said he's been delivering trucks for 20 years to General Motors dealerships. Nobody's ever ordered a truck like that. How are we ever going to sell something that nobody else has ever ordered? I don't know who it was in Mark's corner when he first arrived back in Jerusalem. But I believe that it may have been his mom or may have been his dad. It may have been a sibling. It may have been a close friend. But they began to just talk to Mark about what the disciples had first seen in him. What was it that Barnabas and Paul saw in him that even wanted them to take him even to Antioch with him and then take him along on this trip? And as they began to speak words of encouragement to him, I believe it began to have an impact. I will tell you that Barnabas, when he got back to Jerusalem, he certainly would have taken the time to encourage this young man because Barnabas' name had been changed to Barnabas, which means son of encouragement. That's how Barnabas was known. He was a man who was always there wanting to encourage, always wanting to speak words of life and hope. And he did that into Mark's heart and into his spirit. Boy, when we're down, when we're feeling like failures, it's great to have a person of encouragement come into our world. Because they can help us to deal with those thoughts of rejection. They help us see that failure is only temporary, and it probably may have even only been an isolated incident. Encouragers always focus on our strengths, and then they begin to show us, hey, here's what we can do. Now, let me tell you that when you're in one of those moments where failure has just been a part of your life, and somebody comes along and they begin to encourage you, it's not like taking a vitamin C pill that has immediate impact. I mean, vitamin C, it just gets into your body immediately. No, it's more like a time-release capsule. Because as you're trying to deal with the failure, and you're trying to work through all the issues, and they keep speaking words of life, there's a time release that just continues to happen and begins to pick you up and help you. It helps slowly remove the pain, and it will repair the breach in your heart. Can I say this to you as well? It's really to all of us. That whenever we would come across the path of somebody who's in the midst of some type of failure, we need to be a source of encouragement to them. We need to be speaking words of life. We need to be talking to them about this only being a temporary setback or an isolated incident. We need to remind them that they are not a failure, that it was just this one time, it was just this thing that happened. And so we are called to speak words of life. Encourage one another, the Bible says. We need to remind them that God is focused on their future, not on their past, that God sees their potential. And because God sees their potential, we can see the potential in someone else. What has to happen, though, as we spend time and we begin to analyze, is that there comes a point where we need to start again. Jeff Graham, who attends our church, and I'm not sure how Mary found his blog or how it got to her, but late last night she was reading his blog on failure. And he had a couple statements, and I really think they speak to this idea of starting again. In his, he had 8 points on failure, but here's two of them. Failure is a giant you have to slay. Failure also pushes you out of your comfort zone. If you're going to start again, you're going to have to slay that giant. You're going to have to get out of your comfort zone. Within days of my failure in terms of this truck and what the mistake that I had made, my dad came into me and said, "We need to order more cars." Now, I knew that there's a scheduling to this, and I knew that we weren't really in the time of ordering cars. But Dad said, "We got to order some cars for me." I said, "What am I ordering?" He said, "Here's what." And I thought, "Oh man, I'm going to make another mistake." But I decided I would follow through and get going again because I knew that I had to. I'd be more diligent in terms of making sure that everything I did was right. And I will tell you that once I got those things done, and then when the confirmation came back and the pre-build from General Motors and I saw that I'd done right, it really felt good. Mark wanted to know the same feeling. So he put himself in a position of being willing to go again and to do it right. See, when Barnabas asked if he was ready to go on another missions trip, Mark said, yes, he was. He set his mind in such a way that he saw that what happened was a failure, but he wasn't going to let that, as I said, define him as a failure. What has to take place in our lives is we have to make sure that we don't allow failure to get inside of us. When failure gets inside of us, we look at the future as being dim. We become negative and we become discontented. When this happens, we become a hostage to the event. Remember, we have to let go of what's behind us so we can reach forward to what's in front of us. What happens in our lives when we're chained to the event, when we're really framing our lives by the failure, is that we'll try to rationalize what took place. And excuses will never lead you to achievement. We heard from Janice that she talked about this isolation, for that moment of isolation. There is a tendency to withdraw. We don't want to be around anybody. We just want to live in our own world. We also find ourselves chained to the past in failure when we live with regret. And what regret does, it saps our energy. And if we let it, it can become bitterness. And the inevitable consequence of bitterness is because we have not processed old injuries. What are we to remember? You can't move forward until you deal and let go of your past. So to start again means you say goodbye to yesterday. It's exactly what George Frederick Handel did. He was 56 years old. He was in debt. People weren't buying his music. Nothing was going well. He began to look at his life as being that of a failure. One day in his 56th year, a friend came into his home, handed him a page with some words on it that dealt with the life of Christ. Handel looked at those words, and he sat down at the piano, and for 21 consecutive days, he began to put together the masterpiece that we know as the Messiah. If he had wallowed in self-pity, if he had just stayed with and said, "No, I'm a failure, I can't write anymore, nobody's buying my music," he would never have had the energy to try again, but he started again. And when he did, something incredible came from it. The fourth thing I have found in my own life is this, that when you start again, you make your life count. Janice couldn't be here for the end of this service because of another commitment. But I just want to read to you what she shared in first service. She said, God took me through a process over the months that followed. I learned that God is with me in those low points. I was broken and had to decide if I was willing to surrender my life to God and see what His plan was for me. Over the next months, I did just that. I learned to trust God that He had a plan for me. He taught me that my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. And I was feeling weak. Looking back, I can see God's hand in my life. He did guide me. He did show me that I had other ways that He was going to use me, and I would feel great fulfillment in following that plan. I even had the opportunity to skate again, but in a synchronized skating team where I wasn't on the ice alone, and I had more fun than I had ever had. I learned that many are the plans in a person's hearts, but it's the Lord's purposes that prevails. I don't regret the time I put into skating. I learned perseverance and hard work, and those qualities are indispensable. I also have compassion for those who have failed. God will be faithful to complete His good work in you. It's not over. No question that Janice is making her life count, and so did Mark. He lived out what he believed he could do. Mark's failure really became a stepping stone for God to point him in a new direction. Somewhere on his journey with Barnabas, he was able to spend some time with Peter. So much time that, as we saw, even from that quiz I gave you earlier, that Peter considered him to be a son. There was such an incredible relationship. Peter saw things in him. And as he spent time with Peter, and as he listened to the story, probably got firsthand information, but we also know that John Mark was with Christ, he began to write down the story of Christ. Tradition says that Mark's gospel is the very first biography we have of Jesus. That wouldn't have happened if he hadn't got past and over his failure. God had great things in store for him, and because he was willing to say, I'm going to start again, I am going to make my life count, although he had no idea what that would mean, there is no question that today we understand that he did make his life count. And if you're here today and you're facing failure, you're thinking of yourself as a failure, I can say to you that God has great things in store for you if you will let go of yesterday and look forward to tomorrow. You'll also remember I said earlier that going on Mark on that mission trip with Barnabas wasn't the end of the story. Let me take you to the end. Paul, the one who wanted nothing to do with John Mark, wrote this in 2 Timothy 4:11. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark. Bring him with you, for he is useful to me for ministry. Unbelievable. This young man who had been useless to Paul becomes useful. Why? Because he said, I am going to start again. I'm making my life count. And he did it with Barnabas. He does it with Peter. And so you can well imagine that at some point when those guys saw Paul again, when he came back to Jerusalem and they were just conversing about life, they would talk, well, this is what happened. Oh, yeah, John Mark did that. Oh, yeah, John Mark did this. And he'd be going, he did that and he did that. What has changed in this young man's life? And he made a change. This morning, if you are plagued with thoughts of failure, I'm asking that you would decide to start again and to make your life count.